Episode 90, Noah Webster and His Great 1828 Dictionary.
Welcome to the Principles in Practice podcast. This is where we discuss biblical principles for life and learning. I'm your host, Heather Hall, and this is my co-host,
Brian Hall.
Welcome back to the Principles in Practice homeschool podcast. Today, I have with me our oldest daughter, Keltis.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us, Keltis.
Thanks for having me.
So the very last episode that we did together was episode 35 on neutrality in education.
Mm-hmm.
So if you haven't caught that episode, listeners, I'd encourage you to go find episode 35 and take a listen to that. Well, a lot of things have happened since then. Do you want to get everybody caught up with some things?
Well, I graduated with my Bachelor of Arts in Christian Education early last year. And now I'm working in a private Christian school teaching 4 to 5 year olds.
And having a great time doing it.
Yes, I'm enjoying it a lot and learning a lot during the school year.
Before we continue, we've been notified that we can sound an awful lot alike. So we hope that you can distinguish our voices. We did a heads and tails to see who would speak with a British accent to distinguish between our voices for you guys, but it turns out that I lost. I lost the coin flip, and as Keltis and I were discussing this, we determined that I would probably either drop the accent unintentionally, or we would just laugh the whole way through this. So you're just going to have to do your best to distinguish between our voices.
I promise my mom is not talking to herself.
Okay, so I thought we could begin with a book titled American Men of Letters. It's edited by Charles Dudley Warner and was originally written by Horace E. Scudder in 1881. And there are some interesting things about Noah Webster here while he was going through the process of compiling words and spellings and definitions for unity among Americans with our language. So Horace wrote, "Besides publishing some dissertations on the subject, he issued a new grammar in 1807, based this time on Horne-Tooke's Diversions of Purley, an author with whom Webster would naturally be in sympathy. This grammar never had a firm hold of the public and was subsequently incorporated into the prefatory matter of his great dictionary, where he says," so now Noah Webster's being quoted, "My researches into the structure of the language had convinced me that some of Loth's principles are erroneous and that my own grammar wanted material corrections. In consequence of this conviction, believing it to be immoral to publish what appeared to be false rules and principles, I determined to suppress my grammar and actually did so." Unquote. Horace continues with, "Here we have his frankness of character, his honesty, his force of will, and the impulsiveness with which he took up attractive theories. Perhaps the most comprehensive statement of his ruling principle is that he was governed by usage, but did not sufficiently discriminate between usage by educated and usage by uneducated people. He had, indeed, so violent a prejudice against grammarians in general, and so much respect for popular instinct, that it was a recommendation to him when a phrase was condemned by the grammarians, while in common use by the people. For example, he says in a letter to the governors, instructors, and trustees of the universities and other seminaries of learning in the United States," and now here's a quote from Noah Webster, "according to the grammars, the pronoun you, being originally plural, must always be followed by a plural verb, though referring to a single person. This is not correct. For the moment, the word is generally used to denote an individual. It is to be considered as a pronoun in the singular number. The following verb should be regulated by that circumstance and considered as in the singular. Indeed, in the substantive verb, the word has taken the singular form of the verb, you was, which practice is getting the better of old rules and probably will be established." Unquote. Horace continues, "But old rules have considerable vitality, and the general opinion still is that if an individual permits himself to be represented by a plural pronoun, he must accept all the grammatical consequences." He continues in the same letter, "that 2/3 of all the corruptions in our language have been introduced by learned grammarians, who, from a species of pedantry acquired in schools, and from a real ignorance of the original principle of the English tongue, have been for ages attempting to correct what they have supposed vulgar errors, but which are in fact established analogies. In this country, it is desirable that inquiries should be free and opinions unshackled. North America is destined to be the seat of a people more numerous probably than any nation now existing with the same vernacular language, unless one except some Asiatic nations. It would be little honorable to the founders of a great empire to be hurried prematurely into errors and corruptions by the mere force of authority. Mm-hmm. Unquote.
I appreciate that Webster recognized when he accepted ideas that were in error and that he was willing to retract his work in order to not have something dishonest or inaccurate out there. That was, I think, a good example of his humility and his character.
Yeah, definitely. And I hear in his writings and his explanations that he's honoring the principle of individuality. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily up to those who are considered learned grammarians to make the mm-hmm. decisions on it. And that's not to say that there weren't rules to follow, but like you said, he looks for what's more intuitive mm-hmm. when speaking and stuck with that.
Yeah.
So there's a history of dictionaries by Noah Webster. Some were compiled before his 1828 edition and one afterward. I thought it would be enjoyable to go through that timeline and chat a bit about it.
Okay.
In a bibliography of the writings of Noah Webster by Emily Ellsworth Ford, there's a listing of his dictionaries as well as his other works. He compiled the Compendious Dictionary of the English Language in 1806. Mm-hmm. And then came along the Common School Dictionary of the English Language, which debuted in 1807. It was compiled specifically for the use of common schools in the United States. It's sometimes referred to as an abridgment of the Compendious Dictionary.
Okay, I was curious how he did a different one within 1 year the one that was published before. So,
well, it was going around that was an abridged version of the Compendious Dictionary. Mm-hmm. But we learned from a letter written by Noah Webster to a man named Joel Barlow, and the letter was dated October 19th of 1807, mm-hmm. that's not the case. In that letter, Noah Webster stated, "I have in the press an abridgment of my complete American Dictionary for Common Schools, omitting obsolete and technical terms, and reducing it to a dollar book. With the profits of these, I hope to be able to finish my complete dictionary. It will require the incessant labor of from 3 to 5 years.
Well, I find it funny that he says 3 to 5 years, because the 1828 edition ended up taking 28 years to complete, I believe.
Right, so he kind of underestimated his time a little bit there.
I wonder if it's because he thought there would be less words in it.
Maybe.
Than there ended up being. But I also know that he ended up switching his approach to how he worked on the dictionary shortly after he began. I think he said, like, once he got through, like, two letters, he ended up going back and looking at the origins of the words because he felt embarrassed that he and other people who compiled dictionaries didn't really take the time to look at the origins of the words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That, and then he also had the common spelling and pronunciation to work through.
Oh, yes.
And that had to have been quite the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were lots of variations of, like, spelling and pronunciation during that time.
Yeah. I think it's easy to have a picture of him just sitting at this desk, like, his whole life for several years, just plugging away at this. But he actually did interviews of sorts with people Well, of sorts, where he was listening to the common use of the mm-hmm. language yeah. and then paying attention to what the grammarians were saying. So mm-hmm. he was making all of these notes and notating what he would accept and what he wouldn't accept for mm-hmm. the use of words and what they mean, as well as looking at the original languages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read that he mastered at least 10 languages. I know he looked at more, but he mastered 10 languages. And then he also went across the Atlantic twice to do some more research in, I believe it was England. So lots of work on his part.
Yeah. It was good that he moved around and not stuck at a desk sitting down too much anyway at a time.
Did you read the description of his desk?
No.
I believe it was his granddaughter who wrote that he had like a circular table that had an empty space in the middle where he could sit, and all his books were piled around him. And all so around that circle table. So he was in the middle, mm-hmm. and he had all his resources. And so he'd start with one, and he'd work his way around the table, researching the meanings of words and their origins and stuff. So I thought that was a fun picture.
Yeah, that is. That's really incredible. And so was he in a swivel chair?
I have no idea. They didn't say.
Oh, that's fun. I didn't know about that fact. I don't know. I also have wondered if a lot of the technology that we have today and some of the distractions, like things such as video games, mm-hmm. were around during his lifetime, if he would have stuck to his calling and seen it through so faithfully. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just think that...
I mean, he had to give up a lot, I'm sure, to focus on all that study and research. You know, it took 28 years. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of your life being spent on that. And then he mentioned in the preface to the 1828 dictionary that he dealt with some health issues and some other things, and God saw him through it while he was finishing the dictionary. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. There wasn't a lot of time probably for too much social mm-hmm. interaction. And I mean, obviously he was talking with people and researching and all, so he wasn't isolated, but you know, just as far as just regular,
all the fun stuff.
Yeah, the fun stuff of life. So in 1828 we get the American Dictionary of the English Language Unabridged. There is a later edition that came out in 1841 that was produced with the help of his son William G. Webster. So here's a snippet from Wikipedia, which I know is not a primary source. They just have a little snippet about the history here with that dictionary. Mm-hmm. In 1841, 82-year-old Noah Webster published a second edition of his lexicographical masterpiece with the help of his son, William G. Webster. Its title page does not claim the status of a second edition, merely noting that this new edition was the first edition in octavo, in contrast to the quarto format of the first edition of 1828. Again, in two volumes, the title page proclaimed that the dictionary contained the whole vocabulary of the quarto, with corrections, improvements, and several thousand additional words, to which is prefixed an introductory dissertation on the origin, history, and connection of the languages of Western Asia and Europe, with an explanation of the principles on which the languages are formed. Mm-hmm. So why is it we use the 1828 dictionary?
Well, Webster realized that as Americans, we needed our own dictionary. And there are a few different points that he made. The first is that America is a different nation, and it's founded on different ideas than England was. Mm-hmm. And in the preface to the 1828 dictionary, he states that language is the expression of ideas, and if the people of one country cannot preserve an identity of ideas, they cannot retain an identity of language. Now, an identity of ideas depends materially on a sameness of things or objects with which the person of the two countries are conversant. But in no two portions of the earth, remote from the other, can such identity be found. Even physical objects must be different. From the principal differences between the people of this country and all others rise from different forms of government, different laws, institutions, and customs. And another point he made is that some words in America were used differently than how they were used in England. So he pointed out the word justice, like in relation to justice of the peace, is different in England than it is in America. In England, a justice of the peace was appointed by the king, and we don't have a king here. So that's one of the things he recognized with, like, American form of government. You have to have different definitions. Mm-hmm. And then there were just some errors and irregularities that needed to be corrected. Lots of people pronounced things different ways or spelt things different ways, and he wanted to fix that. And then...
Well, that still happens.
Yes.
Today across the states, though. Like, I grew up pronouncing that maple-flavored liquid that people put on pancakes as syrup, mm-hmm. whereas your dad, who grew up in another part of the country for much of his childhood, pronounced it as syrup. Mm-hmm. And so when we got married, he was like, you know, that syrup, that's just got to go. So I had to train myself to say syrup, just, you know, out of love and respect for him. But then also back east, they pronounce a word a certain way, and we pronounce it differently over here on the West Coast, and that is the word important. We say important mm-hmm. out here, and back there they say important.
Mm-hmm. Yep, lots of subtle differences. Some of them are more obvious than others.
Well, and then there's also the word caramel mm-hmm. and caramel. Uh-huh. And so that's a continual debate in our family. I will not give up caramel because there are three syllables in the word, and that A in the middle has a purpose. I'm not going to ignore it. Whereas my husband will stick with caramel. So,
yeah. And then another thing that makes Webster's dictionary stand out is it's from a biblical worldview. And people have pointed out that he's quoted scripture so many times throughout the dictionary, and he brings things back to God's word. And so when you look at definitions from his dictionary versus modern dictionaries, there's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the differences can be on the subtle side, but when you really think about it, it really impacts how we approach different things based on the meaning of the word.
Yeah, and I think that today we have to be conscientious of the fact that when there is a use of language in documents, that the definitions can be changed. So even mm-hmm. though the language remains the same in some documents, the definition ends up getting changed, and then that has repercussions. Mm-hmm. So it's always important to remember to ask someone, what do you mean when you say, mm-hmm. and ask them specifically for a definition, and that helps to make sure that in discussions you're on the same page mm-hmm. and that you're understanding each other for what you're really saying.
Yeah, and they're constantly changing definitions now and just twisting them from the original meaning and adding things to it that aren't biblical mm-hmm. and it gets very confusing.
Yeah, it's like in the book 1984 we have the old speak and the new speak, and mm-hmm. so there's a lot of the new speak that's going on. And one of the reasons why it is so important for us to be using Webster's 1828 is to master the use of our English language, mm-hmm. to restore it, and also it helps us to master the subjects mm-hmm. that God has created.
Yep.
Well, here's some more interesting facts about Noah Webster. And this is from the Noah Webster House and West Hartford Historical Society website. Noah and Nathan Hale were at Yale at the same time. Hale was 3 years ahead of Noah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He socialized with Ben Franklin, who was known as quite a lively character. And actually, you have a children's book to let everybody know about in a moment mm-hmm. That incorporates Ben in the story. When he asked his father for money to study law, his father gave him worthless currency.
Wow. Was that on purpose?
I presume. Noah loved music and dancing. He once lived in a house in New Haven that belonged to Benedict Arnold.
Oh, wow.
Noah and Rebecca had 6 daughters and 2 sons. He died in 1843 at the age of 85 and is buried in New Haven's Grove Street Cemetery. So tell everybody about that fun book that you discovered.
Well, I was researching about some books by Noah Webster. I came across a children's book titled An Inconvenient Alphabet, Ben Franklin and Noah Webster's Spelling Revolution. And it's by Beth Anderson and Elizabeth Baddeley. And it talks about how Noah Webster and Benjamin Franklin worked together to try to tackle the problem of spelling and pronunciation that they were dealing with in America during the time of the Revolutionary War, and as America was getting more securely founded as a nation. And it's got lots of fun illustrations, and yeah, they have a whimsical look to them and pull in fun elements throughout the whole story, but it's really informative. I think it's pretty accurate from what I understand, And it's a little bit above the age group that I'm currently teaching, but I thought it'd be fun to have on hand anyway.
Yeah, and I think that the authors and the artist caught their personalities so well mm-hmm. and made their friendship seem rather playful.
Yeah.
So, and I think how neat and unique that the two were friends mm-hmm. and that God brought them together in that friendship, because I don't imagine there were very many people who enjoyed listening to either Benjamin or Noah go on and on, perhaps about the English language mm-hmm. and the problem solving and looking at the mechanics of things, yeah. you know? So that was probably a really special friendship.
Yeah. I think so.
Well, do you know where Noah Webster was when he penned the very last word in the dictionary?
Was he in England? I can't remember.
He was. Okay. Yeah. Before I learned that fact, had this impression in my mind that he was on American soil, but he wasn't. He was over in Cambridge, England, where he was lodging. And then there's a quote by him when he was expressing how he was feeling as he was penning that very last word. He said, "When I had come to the last word, I was seized with a trembling which made it somewhat difficult to hold my pen steady for writing. The cause seems to have been the thought that I might not then live to finish the work, or the thought that I was so near the end of my labors. But I summoned the strength to finish the last word, and then walking about the room a few minutes, I recovered."
Yeah, I never thought about how he would have handled writing the last words in there, but I could understand the... Oh, like the anticipation of finishing it and being able to help other people probably caught up to him after all those years, like 28 years. I mean, come on.
Yeah, he had to have been very attached. And I mean, it was just his lifestyle for so mm-hmm. long and his pursuit. So
I know. And he was in his 60s at this point.
Yeah. And we're all extremely thankful for his work and mm-hmm. for the preservation of it. So if you don't have a copy of this big, beautiful, heavy, thick, green book called the 1828 Dictionary of the English Language, then you can go to principledacademy.com and go to shop and find the link for our store and go to FACE Resources, and you can purchase it through us, which helps support our ministry, and it also supports FACE.
Yeah, highly recommend the dictionary. It's really helpful and helps give you a biblical view of the vocabulary that we use and helps you compare with the modern use of words and see how things have changed.
Well, Keltis, thanks so much for joining me for this. It was a lot of fun to talk with you about them and to share together some of what we've learned about Webster and his dictionary and his journey.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for having me.
If you want to learn more about homeschooling with the Principal Approach, then join the Biblical Classical Homeschool Experience membership. You can learn about that at principledacademy.com and get on the wait list for it. The doors will be opening soon. Also, if you want to learn more about word studies, then go to biblicalclassicalcommunity.com and sign up for the course on word studies.
As always, if you're looking for additional resources or support, you can visit our website at principledacademy.com, check out our shop and our blog, and you can also find us on Facebook at Christian Homeschooling with Bible Principles, also on Instagram under Principal Academy. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Well, this is Heather Hall.
And this is Brian Hall.
For Christ and His glory.